and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. On today's episode, I'm joined by the sportsman, adventurer and double Olympic gold medalist, James Cracknell. We first got to know James as part of the Coxless 4 rowing team alongside Steve Redgrave that won gold at the Sydney Olympics. Several world titles later, James went on to take part in countless feats of endurance, from becoming the highest ever placed Brit to run the Marathon des Sables, the hottest, hardest race in the world, to rowing the Atlantic in a two-man boat and racing to the South Pole with his friend Ben Fogel, who you might have heard on the podcast earlier this season. Then in 2010, James's life was turned upside down. While cycling in a race across America, he was struck by a lorry and experienced a serious brain injury that left him in a coma. As we discuss, his journey to recovery has been anything but straightforward, but his story is one of sheer determination and resilience, ultimately leading him to return to university, Cambridge no less, where he became the oldest ever winner of the famous Oxbridge boat race. Travel has been hugely important to James. Of course, he spent a lot of time on some of the world's most beautiful lakes and rivers, and I love being by the water, so I really enjoyed hearing about those. And his Slovenian all-time favourite destination is a spot that I've now added to my travel wish list, and I'm sure you might do too. There's a lot to cover today, so let's get started. Here are the travel diaries of James Cracknell. James Cracknell, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thanks so much for joining me today. How are you?
Very good. No, thank you very much.
So we're speaking remotely. You're in London. I'm in the countryside at the moment. And travel is gradually getting going again. As someone who is so active and busy normally, how did you handle those months of stricter lockdown?
I basically, I think a lot of sports were the same. Well, the sport I did in rowing, that a lot of our time was spent training, not racing. So we only race maybe a handful of times a year. And so we used to go on training camps where it was like Groundhog Day. So being locked down, I haven't suffered with the doing the same thing every day, because I spent a long part of my life doing that. I think the one thing about traveling is that I did it before, and I would go to various rowing lakes around the world. So I'm an expert in lakes around the world, but it's nice to go somewhere where you don't have to take a boat with you and you have a freedom to do things. And so, yeah, I've missed that side of it. And also with kids as well, seeing it through their eyes, because they're seeing things for the first time that you're used to seeing, and they're just saying, wow, it's, you know, things that you don't see.
That gives a whole new appreciation for travel in a way, seeing it through their eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're very lucky in that they've been to places that I didn't see and see things that I didn't see. I didn't go on a plane until I was 18.
Okay, so now's a great time to start off your travel diaries. Chapter one is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Yeah.
You didn't go on a plane until you were 18. So were your early holiday memories in the UK?
No, actually, we used to go camping in France a lot.
Ah, right, okay.
I guess my parents, they weren't wealthy. In fact, one of my granddads won the pools, and so they still have that very money saving. Yeah, the only brand name we used to have was ketchup. Heinz ketchup. Everything else was own brand, and so they still had that mindset of actually, like, where is it going to go? It could all go tomorrow. And so we said camping in France, which is brilliant, but the cheapest ferry was always like 5 a.m. So my earliest memory is getting woken up in the middle of the night, basically half asleep in the car on the way to Dover. And as we got older, even then, we're still doing it when we were like 12 or 13. I'm like, can we not get a later ferry? Why do we have to start the holiday at like 4 a.m? So those are the first ones. So I guess the first travel memory is getting in the car when it was dark.
Yeah.
To drive over.
Do you remember where in France you'd go to?
We'd make our way down to the forest in the south of France, sort of near. Well, I guess the west coast of Biarritz, and then down to the lakes. The French are so lucky in that it's got such a big footprint, and Paris is such a dominant city in the country that all roads lead there, but there's so much there's so many other spaces around there. And what I really loved about it, and still do really like about France, actually, is that every town is, they're very proud of their towns in a way that we haven't got the same thing here. And every town has a big community centre, be that sports, be that market, be that a showground. Or they do have a travelling circus or traditional French sort of activities that they do. And that was just, and every town has that. And that was kind of like, that's a really good community spirit within France. And then also, I do like the way that they don't speak English. Yeah, they really, and if you make an effort to speak French, they'd be much more friendly. But if you didn't make any effort to speak French, they can't be bothered.
Yeah. And when did you first get into rowing?
First started rowing 13 or 14. I went to school where someone broke their neck at playing rugby. So they stopped rugby and went to school in Kingston. Wow. And then it was by the river. So they started a boat club. And I guess I played rugby for a club outside of school. And then when I started rowing, I did that. So, so 13. And then I guess I got sort of pretty serious about it at 16 or 17, which is actually when I stopped going on holiday with my parents, because we'd have Great Britain International Racing at 16, 17, 18 in the summer, and then at the sort of under 18 World Championships. And so that was the school summer holidays taken care of.
And you made this choice to commit. So we first got to know you rowing in Team GB alongside Sir Steve Redgrave and winning Olympic gold medals. So looking back at that time, are they happy memories?
Yeah, I mean, so 2000 was a very special year. Those 4 years up to the Olympics, so you kind of break it down to Olympiad. So from 97, 98, 99, 2000 is all one Olympiad. But it's a long time to get there. I won the under-18 World Championships in 1990, and I was selected for the Barcelona Olympics, and I broke my shoulder, so I missed out on those. And then I got ill when I was in Atlanta for the next Olympics. So I'd sort of been selected for two Olympic Games and only made the start line on the third. And at that point, I was mid-20s, and I was in a huge amount of debt because there was no funding in sport at that point. And so, you know, my dad's an accountant. He was going, look, at some stage, you're going to want to buy a house, and nobody's going to want to marry you if you're in debt and can't buy a house and you're 30. Although, you know, the reality is I don't think many 30-year-olds buy a house now anyway. But the point, you know, when people who've backed you all the time are saying, look, actually, you're not a footballer, you're not making any money from your sport, it's that kind of commitment. And we used to train 7 days a week for 6 weeks, then have a day off. So all your weekends are gone. So there are no travelling away for weekends. And so it is that kind of commitment. But at the same time, you build up a bond of trust with people that you do sport with than is deeper than any other bond I've found.
So rowing has taken you to some amazing waterways and lakes all over the world. Are there some that stand out to you in particular as being the most breathtaking?
There's a lake in south of France called Aigbelette. Well, I'm sure they pronounce it differently, which is near, I guess, the nearest airport's probably Lyon, and near Aix-les-Bains. And that's just, it's the warmest lake in France. It's a really, it's a sort of blue that you can't imagine a lake is that blue. And then there's mountains all around it with huge thermals on it. So they have people in paragliding up there that just sort of sit on the thermals all day. And you do wonder why you're in a rowing boat when they're up there skimming around. You think that looks a lot more fun. We used to go up to a lake at altitude, which is in Galta in Austria, or just above Galta, which is a glacial melt lake. So it obviously a reservoir, it fills up over the summer. And we were the only country that went up there training, just our men's team went up there. And it's in the shadow of Pisbuin and wild cows and horses trotting around. And then you kind of very isolated, which is special. Mm. And then I didn't row on it, actually, but the lake where the Rio Olympics were, I was out there commentating. Mm-hmm. So normally, if you're at the Olympics, the the rowing lakes are sort of man-built massive swimming pools or a big lake out of the city, whereas the lake in Rio was right in the center of the city, pretty much, and right in the shadow of Christ the Redeemer. So if you look up from the start, you've got Christ on the hill, and yeah, that's a very special place.
That sounds spectacular. An added bonus to a destination that's already so special.
Yeah.
So let's move on then to chapter two, which is the first place you fell in love with. What would that be?
It would be one of the like, we very rarely went back to the same sort of area of France twice, even though we were camping all the time. But it was Annecy in the summer, because people go skiing there in the winter. But actually, the mountain, those resorts in the summer are amazing, because they've got all the infrastructure that people have for skiing, but yet they'll have massive lakes, they have amazing hills, whether you go biking, whether you go walking, whether you sit by the lake, rather than being trapped in a hotel with a pool and a kind of games room. Actually, you basically have a playground of everything from lake to snow peaks that you can still reach the snow in the middle of summer. It's amazing. So I think that's the natural variety in that place was what captured me, because pretty much all of those things you don't have in Britain. You know, the Lake District's lovely, but they're still a bit chilly in the winter.
Mm.
But you've got a warm lake, you've got snow if you walk up there or get the cable car up there. You've got amazing mountain bike routes. It's just a very good playground.
Has so much to offer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's plenty of places like that in France. Is blessed by, you know, the Alps and the Pyrenees as well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country. Somewhere that I covered as a destination special earlier this season, actually. So if people want to hear more about France, do tune into that. So you went on to win 2 Olympic rowing golds, 6 World Championship golds, and you then turned your attention to some other enormous physical challenges. The first couple with your friend Ben Fogel, who was on the podcast earlier this season, rowing in a 2-man boat across the Atlantic and then racing to the South Pole, both extraordinary achievements. Interestingly, the South Pole is one of the most popular destinations that my guests pick for the top of their travel bucket lists, Antarctica.
Oh, okay.
I can't imagine your experience of it is necessarily what they might be expecting. So I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about your experience of it, though.
I guess the experiencing Antarctica is because of what you read about it. If you're going through, whether it be the worst journey in the world or Shackleton's endurance expedition, or you know, read about Scott or everything, is that what a awful, inhospitable place it is. And it's, for me, it was more of actually, right, well, what is it like? And you know, those guys obviously had to overwinter there, where it's 24 hours of darkness for a huge amount of time, so they could actually set off and give themselves the best shot of getting to the South Pole. And a part of me wanted to experience it under a time pressure. Whereas if you're going on an expedition or more of a holiday type trip where you do it at your own pace and you work around your fatigue rather than doing it when you don't want to do it. And that's when you kind of make mistakes there, in terms of you have to read the weather and when to put your tent up, because if the wind gets up, then you're in a world of trouble if you haven't got your everything ready and locked down in time. And those decisions are harder to make when you're tired. And so I think living it is never going to be like those guys did, and I wouldn't want it to be. But under a little bit of pressure to put yourself in a very uncomfortable environment in an incredibly isolated place was very lucky. I think going back to where we, the South Pole is on the plateau, the ice plateau, and that's not the most exciting place in Antarctica. To be honest, the most exciting place is around the edge, because that's where you have the wildlife, that's where you have the rocks, that's where you have everything that you picture, whether it be, you know, killer whales, seals, penguins. You know, they don't hang around in the middle, they're all on the edge. So I think that would be the places to explore. The middle, it's, and the mountains, walking up through them, actually trekking up through the mountains to the plateau is amazing, because things that you don't really realize is that the average height of the continent is the highest continent on the world, Antarctica.
I hadn't realized
because
it's the ice
for the plateau. The plateau is, you know, the size of Europe. That it's a mile thick, the ice, and so all the mountains are under a mile of ice. So it's so you're basically walking at over 2,000 meters when you're there because you're on that much ice.
So does it feel like you're walking at altitude?
Yeah, you do feel, and you climb as you walk up onto the or trek up onto the plateau. But what you don't picture when you're there, obviously the horizon is endless white, and the sun when we were there was 24-hour sunlight. But you know, if you think of all the fresh water in the world, 40% of the world's fresh water is frozen on Antarctica.
Wow.
And there's a lot of made, rightly so, about global warming. But if Antarctica melted, global sea levels would rise by 50 metres.
It's hard to comprehend.
And so London would be 45 metres underwater if Antarctica melted. Now that's that gives you a sense of the scale of the place.
Yeah.
And what the changes in the environment are happening there. And so, you know, that's why there is the pact of not drilling under Antarctica for oil that is there. And all countries have ratified that. And I'm sure some will be getting twitchy about it and want more oil. But the reality is if we muck around with that ice plateau, then we're lining up future generations for a huge amount of trouble.
Yeah, it's so important for us to be constantly reminded of facts like that. And did it feel unfeasibly big when you were walking across it?
Yeah, it's unfeasibly big.
An incredible environment, and I'm sure a place where you learned a lot about yourself. Chapter 3 is the place where you learned the most about yourself. Where else has been a game changer for you?
Actually, it was another trip I went on with Ben Fogel when we rode across the Atlantic, because similar to Antarctica, you're a very small dot on a massive landscape. You know, we were in a 7-meter boat for nearly 50 days, just the two of us. And again, a small dot. And as one did, if I had a big wave, would just flip you over any time. And it does make you feel very vulnerable. But also, incredibly, if there's one other person there, you can get quite bored of him quickly. And you spend a lot of time in your own head. And a lot of time thinking. And I think that was where I really, I think for the first time, became comfortable in my own company.
Mm.
Being on a boat with no internet, you had a sat phone, but that was really expensive. You need to keep it charged up for safety. You didn't really, you know, you have one other person to talk to. And half the time, when I was rowing, he was asleep. When he was rowing, I was asleep. So you have to get used to and be happy in your own company. It took me, I think that was the hardest thing to get used to, is that being out there in my own head. You spend pretty much 12 hours a day on your own. And now I don't, you asked right at the start, how's lockdown been? I haven't got a problem with it. That could mean I'm really antisocial, but I kind of can occupy my own head pretty well.
And that trip led you to be at peace with your own company?
Peace with my company. And also, I'm not sure so many of them appreciated it, but where you've let people down or behave badly. So I came back and I phoned up a few ex-girlfriends and apologized for bad behavior when I was younger.
Really?
Why are you calling me now? Like, I was stuck in my own head and I felt really bad for 2 days about this. You know, and they're going, that was 15 years ago. I've got over it. You weren't that special. Don't worry. I haven't mourned you for 15 years. You know that, but those, you kind of, it makes you think and ask yourself questions that,
yeah,
I don't think in everyday life we don't ask ourselves questions about behavior, or about how you are when you walk into a room, and if you radiate, or if you sort of, you know, are a drain on a room, you know, all those things.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Right now, our physical and mental health and wellness has never felt so important, has it? And there's one place that can help you to look after all three. Right in the heart of Mayfair, Lanzerhof at the Arts Club combines the best in fitness and medicine and is available to both members and non-members. The medical services offered by orthopedists, general practitioners and cardiologists are complemented by a team of physiotherapists, osteopaths and chiropractors who use pioneering analytics and equipment to create bespoke health and well-being plans. State-of-the-art medical technology like in-house MRI scanners and a spine and movement lab complement their holistic approach. Exclusive to the club's members are the gym, fitness classes, training with amazing personal trainers, as well as access to a members lounge with a range of healthy dishes based on the Lanzerhof energy cuisine. And next year, this is so exciting, they've got a big new opening, Lanzerhof Silt, which is the first Lanzerhof to be built by the sea. It looks like it will be truly a spectacular place to relax and look after your health. So head over to lanzerhof.com for more information about all of this and book your visit now. It's interesting, when Ben came on the podcast, he also chose the Atlantic Row as a place where he learned the most about himself. So it was clearly a formative time for both of you.
Did he tell you that he learned that this is, I guess, embarrassing. My dad's brilliant. But It was really hot. We were rowing pretty much close to the equator. And it was really hot. And it was outside in the middle of the day with no hat on. I was like, Ben, you're going to get a heat stroke. Put a hat on. And he was going, no. Heat stroke's genetic. I was like, mate, heat stroke is not genetic. The name of it tells you. And that about 6 hours later, he's throwing up over the side, going, I don't feel well, I'm not eating something.
Oh, God.
I go, look, we're eating expedition rations, nothing, they're freeze-dried, they can't go off. And then I think he did realise that heat stroke wasn't genetic because he wore a hat the next day. But yeah, he definitely learned some things on that trip.
Yeah, it sounds like something that you'd never, ever repeat, but that was so important to do.
Yeah, I wouldn't really fancy being stuck in a small boat for that long. But it also, the reason I think we both went to the South Pole with each other is that although we're very different people and approaching things differently, I have absolute trust in him. And and the same, I guess, from him to me, that he's also, he may not be as competitive as me, but he is as stubborn as anything. If he says he's going to do something, he does it. And I have real trust in him. I think that's something you only build up through shared experience. And he was great to work with.
And Ben, I know, was a big support at the time of your brain injury. For the listeners who might not be aware of exactly what it was that you went through, quite how serious it was,
Would you be able to just explain briefly what happened back in 2010?
Yeah, I was doing a travel, endurance travel program for Discovery Channel, which was crossing America from one side to the other. Whether it be, I was cycled from LA, then ran through Death Valley, and then was cycling up to Chicago, going to row one of the Great Lakes up there, and then get back on the bike and end up in New York. So crossing America and the wonderful variations of landscape that it has under your own steam, having a real mental map of the country, because I think one thing we do lose with planes and trains, and you don't really get the same mental map as you do if you travel it by human power and take in the massive scale and variety of the place. So I was cycling through Arizona, and it was early one morning, and I got hit from behind by a fuel truck. His wheel mirror smacked me on the back of the head, and I got a helicopter to hospital, and then was in a put me in a coma because of brain swelling, and I came out sort of 10 days later and had no idea what had happened, and all I did know is people were looking at me very strangely.
Yeah.
Although everything seemed to look okay to me. And Ben was one of the first people that came out. He was on holiday with his family and dropped everything and flew out to be there. And that was a huge, hugely important for Bev, my wife, at the time, having his support out there, and someone that knew me, has spent so much time with me in difficult situations. And I'm forever thankful for that. The reality is that he was there for a week, and I have no memory of him being there.
Gosh.
But it was that's what true friendship and real trust is about. He was amazing, and he's amazing.
So that's 10 years ago now.
It was 10 years ago yesterday, actually.
Really? How did that feel, having that anniversary come around?
Yeah, my mum sent me a happy day you should have died text.
Oh, God, your poor mum.
That's a very macabre humour. Yeah, I was like, thanks, mum. Yeah, no. A lot of things have happened that it makes you thankful for things you take for granted, and also the impact of it is still being felt in terms of, so my wife, who was pregnant with our third child whilst I was in a coma, we're getting divorced at the moment, and it definitely, especially my eldest lad, who's was doing his GCSEs this year, was six when the accident happened, and it definitely changed our relationship for a good few years.
Yeah,
in terms of for the first 3 years after, between he was six and nine, when the best thing you want for your parents is consistency and love, and I was very inconsistent because I didn't really know what was going on, especially for the first 18 months. So I was a lot more angry.
So the injury actually affected your behavior and your moods in your everyday life?
Yeah, definitely. And and then when I recovered, but the problem is that it's not like recovering from a broken leg when you're in a cast and then you limp a bit and then crutches and then you're back to normal. It's an unseen injury. And people's and it's unknown as well, really. Thankfully, yes. Not many people have an experience of it or really understand it. And even neurosurgeons go, well, the brain's really complicated. And I'm going, well, hopefully you know about it more than most. But it's the thing is that people's perceptions of, even if they've known you or haven't known you, their perceptions of what you can do change. And I think one of the reasons that Bev and I really struggle, we tried and tried, is that whatever happened, I'm always, in her eyes, seems to be the prism of a brain injury, rather than, we're married for 17 years, rather than people change over 17 years anyway. But there's something different between people changing ordinarily and, watching your husband and dad to two kids at that time and third on the way, having a picture of an apple and then the nurse telling you that's an apple, is trying to, the basic things that you do with a child when I first came out of a coma. So I think that must change the way you're viewed by someone who's your partner rather than your parent.
Yeah, I imagine that must just be so tough. And as you say, particularly because the injury is invisible, this is something that so many people face. You can tell them You can tell them repeatedly how it's affected you, but if you look okay, it's very hard for people to reconcile that in their minds, which of course is so upsetting.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if I'd lost a leg, you'd be treated differently, but there would be a visual reminder of something, and then whereas there isn't anything, so people either for a while thought he's quite. I was definitely. I didn't want to go out for a number of years. Just I didn't. I think like the way I felt I was being treated, or people were behaving differently, and then people think you're antisocial, and friends are going to call up so many times, and if you can't be bothered to get back to them, or they don't hear from you, they think, well, he's not the same. Mm. And that's hard, and I think that's one of the reasons I actually went to study at Cambridge 2018-19 as a way of proving to people and to Bev, my wife at the time, was if I can get accepted by Cambridge, pass a course at Cambridge and then do sport at Cambridge, I did the boat race, then that'll stop people saying, are you the same?
Yeah.
You think, well, actually, you could do high-level sport, pass a master's at a good university. I'd earn the right to people to say, well, actually, okay, he's as good as he was. Whether that's any good or not is another question, but at least that's a way of proving it. And, you know, I handed my thesis in this time last year, so I handed it in on the anniversary of the accident. And if the one difficult thing is that, yeah, I think in society we're very quick to set limits on what people can do, and the neurologists the neuropsychologists are the same. If I told them I wanted to go and do that, they'd have gone, no, you really need to think about more realistic targets. Whereas I'm a passionate believer in you set your targets and find a way to get there, then you've got every chance of getting there.
Well, with that 10-year anniversary in mind, it's amazing what you've achieved and how you continue to inspire people with your fearless attitude. So let's get back to the diaries and on to chapter 4, which is your all-time favourite destination.
I think the place that I enjoyed most was the first time I went to Bled in Slovenia.
Oh, I want to go there so much. So please tell me all about it.
It's an amazing. I mean, it's slightly biased in that there's an amazing lake there.
Yeah, Lake Bled. Yeah,
and the town is based around the lake. And I've been actually now. I've been there in winter and summer. In winter, it all freezes over. When, you know, Slovenia and the ex-Yugoslavia is fantastic water sport. Oh, sorry, winter sport nation. But they have, yeah, the lake is a big feature of the town, what draws people there. And they have they cut the lake freeze in winter, and they cut this sort of channel around the edge for the swans and ducks and geese to swim around.
Oh.
And so they keep this channel open just by constantly swimming. So there's this sort of beautiful parade that goes past. And then it's, you know, everything's fans around the lake and the mountains there, and then just about maybe an hour off of it, they've got this amazing, I did geography as a degree, but it was amazing caves of stalactites and stalagmites that you can visit there. And the best place to stay, or the best place I stayed was, so Tito, who was the old president of Yugoslavia, he's got this, his summer palace was in Lake Bled, and it's a hotel now. And as long as, don't get me wrong, all these ex-Eastern, you know, the Ceausescus of this world, they did so many appalling things. But what he, and ostentatious, but he had the 1970s design in this place is still the same. So if you can imagine a very kitsch place with 70s design, this is the opposite, in that everything is original and it's still kept the same, and it's just the most fantastic place to stay. It's unbelievable. And in terms of, you know, there's no expense spared in building it and decorating it, but it's kept in that sort of timeless place, and then it's right next to the lake. So I think it just really is a very, and it's not that expensive, not like you're staying in a palace with palace prices. It is just very beautiful.
So I just looked it up. It's called Villa Bled. What a setting.
There's an island in the middle with a church on it, and you get out to the island, and you can ring the bell in the church that gives you luck and make a wish, And so, you know, I swam out. You can swim out to the island if you choose to go that way. But it's a fantastic. It's beautifully clean water as well. It's a really special place, winter or summer.
Oh, right. Next year, I'm adding that to my travel wish list, definitely. How about Chapter 5, which is your hidden gem, your favourite secret spot?
Well, it sounds like from speaking earlier, you've done a whole podcast on France. But I genuinely think there are amazing places in France. There are so many unknown lakes.
Agreed.
Because it is, okay, France has the same population as the UK, but so much of it is vast and empty and beautiful. And there's also, I mentioned Aigbelette near a sort of mineral town called Aix-les-Bains, AIX. There's loads of smaller lakes around there, and it's just fantastic to travel there. And it's not almost a hidden spot. You can flip campsites every 2 days and just be in a different place.
Do you find yourself drawn to water now when you travel, now that you're not rowing?
I do. I'd say I enjoy going out in the ocean, but I think lakes are very special, because the best beaches are really busy or really isolated. But I think the lakes are as easy, especially if you go to sort of, you know, a Canadian lake, in a cabin on a Canadian lake. And yes, it's a sport lake in that you had a canoe, you had a sailboat, and there was a motorboat there as well. But you still, is it enough in the forest that you'd make your own firewood? And, you know, I think just being near a lake, it's very different to being, I love the sea, but it's salty, and B, the beaches, are, you know, you get sand everywhere, and it's just, oh, is that, you know.
Yeah, that is a hassle.
A picnic on a beach, it sounds great, but the reality is it's just windy and sandy, and you may have sand sandwiches to start with, whereas a lake, they've often got grass down to the edge, which is brilliant. I think it's a fantastic way to do it. And you go to somewhere, a lake in a hot country, and then you suddenly got warm water as well. It's not like going to a freezing lake in England. So, and then it's very easy in a lot of these places, you know, France, Italy, Canada's got some amazing lakes, in that you are actually pretty isolated, but in a very safe place.
My favourite lake is Lake Maggiore. Oh, yeah. Have you been there?
Yes. Yeah, in Italy. Yeah. We used to train, a place called Varese, which is nearby.
It's magnificent, isn't it?
Yeah, and they're, you know, again, the Italians are very, very lucky, you know, and you don't have to go to Como or, you know, all the big ones with the expensive houses on it. There's just as good lakes around, and almost the towns around those lakes and villages around are more welcoming because of it.
Yeah, because they're not overwhelmed by tourism in the same way.
Yeah, and they welcome you to come rather than just going and being another one trying to support George Clooney at his house on Lake Como.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in contrast, Chapter 6 is the place that you'd never go back to. Where would that be?
Well, I'd like to go back to it, but I think it'd be more of the same. I did geography at university. I was a geography teacher for a bit before I did Olympic stuff. And America's full of the most, very few countries have Alaska at the top. And then you go right down to the swamps of Florida and New Mexico, and fascinating place. But then also you've got the Grand Canyon, which is a phenomenal geographical landmark. And I went to, but yeah, everything is just, it's almost so, policed is the wrong way. It is, obviously, you can't let something like that be run amok, but it's almost, there's not enough freedom to do stuff there in terms of responsible freedom for doing it. And there's lots of instructions, and it just takes the joy of exploring such a mammoth geographical feature. Because it's hard to picture in your head what it's like. But there just seems to be a lot of restrictions there that when I went there, and you don't have any freedom to really explore it.
Oh, I suppose I really never looked at it that way. I was there last year, actually. You're right about it. You're definitely right about it being a place that everyone has to visit once. The scale of it is just hard to fathom, isn't it? Just an amazing place. And there's no one that I feel is more qualified to talk to us on the extremes of weather than you. You've experienced the freezing cold in places like the South Pole and the Canadian Yukon when you were taking part in the coldest race on Earth, and then the extreme heat of the desert in the Marathon de Sable, and when you crossed Oman's empty quarter. So Which is truly worse, would you say?
Well, I'd say the one similar thing about whether it be, you know, the Sahara or Antarctica is they're very similar because they're both deserts. You know, one's a white desert and one's, you know, a dry desert in terms of, you know, sand. And they're actually, they're pretty easy. You got to, okay, there's nothing bad apart from freezing temperature and mistakes that are going to get you in Antarctica. And, you know, there's some nasty wildlife in Sahara, but it's, you don't get ill there because there's not, you know, there's loads of viruses flying around in those places. So that side of it, it's okay. And take Antarctica, even when we're skiing along, taking sledges, sweat, and, or, you know, when you stop, the sweat in your top would freeze to you. But then you hang it, you go to sleep, and then you hang it on the guy rope, and they've got this, in Antarctica, they have the sublimation, which, so there's no state of water. So if you put a freezing top on a guy rope, in the morning, it'll be freeze dried. So there'll be no water. It won't go from frozen ice to soaking wet. It will go from frozen ice to dry. So those things are actually really good because there's no precipitation. Some places in Antarctica hasn't rained for over a century or snow. So they're quite easy. The worst place in that sense is humidity. So having spent time in the Amazon, it's rubbish. A, everything is trying to eat you from tiny bugs to bloody massive snakes. And you're either wet and really hot, or about to get wet and really hot, and so it's just, and then there is loads of infections there. So it's a whole different sense. And in terms of how you survive there, a lot of it is you have obviously dry bags that roll up, and you have your day clothes, your wet clothes, and then your night clothes. So you've got to keep your night clothes dry, and you build a, you know, a shelter and a tent, because you have to be off the ground because everything's trying to eat you on the ground. And so as long as you've got your dry kit dry, you can have under shelter a decent night's sleep. But then in the morning, you've got to put your wet clothes on because you're in wet clothes all day, or they're going to get wet. So, but you need to keep your wet stuff wet and your dry stuff dry. So
that's the least comfortable.
Yeah. And it's, I have friends in the armed forces, and it's, they talk about husbandry, which is, you know, just getting organized and prepared. And if you have bad husbandry, you can get away with a bit of bad husbandry in a desert, whereas bad husbandry in the Amazon, that's it. You're in for a world of pain. So humidity is the worst, I think.
Yeah. So James, we're coming to the end of your travel diaries, the final chapter, which is chapter 7. That is a destination at the top of your travel bucket list.
They're pretty hard to get to, but I think the Tabletop Mountains, or Tepuy, I think they're called, in Venezuela and South America. They rise out of a massive jungle. They're called, well, the locals call them House of the Gods, because basically they're up above the trees and they're dead flat on the top, and they're stunning. I mean, if you look at Google Earth and have the photos, they're just the most amazing things. And I think to see them in real life would be phenomenal. And again, it's, you can work out how some of the mountains are formed. You know, the Himalayas are formed by, you know, two plates colliding. Others are formed by subduction zones. You've got the volcanic islands. But these, I struggle to work out how they're formed, and then have so much vegetation around them. It's amazing.
What a great bucket list destination, one we've not heard about before on the podcast. I hope you make it there one day.
Yeah, I think that's one you have to get a plane to, I reckon. But it'd definitely be amazing to see.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, James Cracknell. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ollie.
Oh, that was James Cracknell. What an inspiring man. I mean, such a story of determination and true grit to, you know, go above and beyond the odds. So I really hope you enjoyed hearing those travel diaries. I really loved speaking to James. If you liked this episode, why not subscribe and get new episodes weekly? You can do that for free on all the podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, and Castbox. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you.
And for everything else podcast related, visit thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.